Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Adam. It's been a while.
Hey, Fred. Hey. I know.
Hey, summer's over. We're all done.
No, it's not. No, it's not. This past weekend, I had a good boating lake weekend. It was 80 degrees. It was crazy for 2 days in the middle of September. So we went crazy and had our last hurrahs with my extremely reliable boat, which is fantastic.
So you didn't break it, right? You were out there testing it, seeing if you could break it.
I definitely Adam-ified it, if that's a word, the winter or late last year, because it, remember that whole fuel injection thing where it's a 97 and they put a General Motors fuel injection system on it, like last minute when they were trying to compete with it and just kind of rushed it to market. And so it had a lot of like automotive style connectors that are in a highly humid environment. So over the years didn't do good.
Right.
So I ripped the entire thing apart and did an entirely different redesign. And to some degree, I got rid of, I think of like 72 electrical connections. I replaced with one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I simplified it pretty dramatically. And this season was every time you turned the key, it ran, which is surprisingly like an entirely different experience with a boat because you plan days around a boat, right? Like you have people come over for a boating day. And if it doesn't run, the whole day is, you know.
So they're looking at you with your head down in the engine compartment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The only thing's worse is you take them out and it breaks out there and you're like, hey, everybody, who likes to row?
So any good swimmers in the group?
Exactly. Who could hold a rope in their teeth and swim?
Right. Now I've got to ask you though, as you look, I mean, I don't want it to turn into a use case 7 scenario, but you have a lot of experience with automotive vehicles in general, including your boat and all of that kind of stuff, right? So you bring a lot of analysis and experience to go, you know, these are not the right connectors for this environment. You didn't have to go out and test 15 kinds of connectors for 2 seasons to see what worked. You swapped them out for, you know, marine grade ones and you were off and running, right? But I run into organizations that they struggle between the two, right? Do I just pay the extra and get the really good stuff? Or do I test 15 different kinds here and hope we get one that works good enough?
Yeah.
I've run into that scenario a few times, but I think there's a much bigger general approach here.
And this is, you know, it's not a mistake. The conversation's turned this way because you and I were arguing about it before we even turned on the recorder earlier. And we were like, and I think when it got to the point where you said, I'm going to hold my tongue till we actually do an episode, I'm like, all right, fair enough. Let's go. Let's do it. I started stretching out my shoulders and arms. I'm like, all right, let's do this.
Yeah. I'm glad I'm 3,000 miles away.
I'm going to get animated here over here. My arms are flying or whatever. So, okay. So I think it's more fundamental. Let's take it down to a more fundamental level. And it's not simply, you know, do I buy this or buy that? It's, I have a design, I need to improve some factor, the technology, the reliability, the cost point, something. And for my specific situation, do I invest in a lot of analytical engineering work or do I invest in a lot of testing? And that's the question.
Yeah, but you're going to test it anyway.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Oh,
you,
yeah.
You
oh,
personally.
Oh.
You're going to push.
I have a use case 7 every week. Do you want to hear my use case 7?
No. But I'm just saying, I just know you. We'll save that for another episode. But I know you. You're gonna do the analytical work. You bring your experience to the table, right? And you say, you know, if you're in this environment, get this one. Analytical doesn't mean you have to do a bunch of finite element analysis and do physics of failure analysis, but you can pull from experience in the analysis piece. And I think most designers do that. That's
my point. That's analysis, because analysis is built on modeling, equations, things that have been established, right? Usually through tests, right? So, but here's the thing though, it's not just picking existing technology, it's developing your technology where it really gets hard, right? Because
then there's a lot of unknowns.
Somebody else's R&D is really easy. I mean, I didn't invent anything with that boat. I just applied what I knew as the best technologies from, you know, my experience and stuff. But the real question is, you know, the people who are creating technology, that's, that's where the question gets hard, because that's where the big money is, right?
Right. Well, there's a lot of unknowns. You know, we got this new formulation for ceramic. Is this going to be too brittle? Is it going to have enough conductivity? Is it going to do this? Is it going to do that? They don't know.
And so the value we're going to give to our listeners in this episode is guidance on how you decide which path, right? Is that what our actual debate is?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the way I usually talk about it is there's two philosophies to go into reliability development work, right? And I used to, you know, I was in a room with Greg Hobbs and Wayne Nelson. So Greg is build, test, fix, break it as quick as you can and fix it. Find where your limits are and go to the fundamental limits and just keep testing. And on the other side is Wayne Nelson, who wrote the book on accelerated testing and the statistical approach to analyzing your test results and creating formulas. And the intent was really a precursor to what we now call physics of failure, is create the models, fully understand your failure mechanisms, and then you can really streamline any testing or avoid it if you design it according to that deep knowledge of the failure mechanisms. Greg's saying you just need to understand it good enough to know if you can improve it. And Wayne's saying, no, you characterize it.
And so what's the plus minuses then for each of those paths that would, for your specific situation, because both answers are right, but it's dependent on the situation, right?
It is. If you're doing I think I'd have to sit down and think about all the plus minuses in both, but those are two extremes to the approach that many teams take. Right?
So let's take one, because you and I started talking about one that was a really great canvas for this discussion before we started.
Okay.
You said the Apollo rocket program.
Right. At the system level, right, they didn't build dozens of Saturn V full stack missiles and rockets and fire them off, right? They check the engine, they check the fuel injection, they check the solid fuel proponents and how well they burn. They look at individual components and tested those individually. But at the system level, they only built a couple of those.
Wasn't a lot of test shots in the space and see what happens. That wasn't the way it worked.
No, they put astronauts on the top of some pretty early ones and, it worked. And they learned a lot. But they also did – it was a mix in my mind. But I've seen this with organizations that creating a prototype of their system, even if it's just getting a piece of ASIC, of a silicon fabricated, and they know they need custom silicon – that's an expensive operation to make 10 of them, right? If you're going to make a million of them, you can do it. But now you're committed. What if it doesn't work? And so those teams tend to look to simulation tools and modeling tools and so on to make sure that their design of the silicon will do what they think it's going to do. And they do an amazing amounts of simulations and modeling and characterization work to make sure before they pull the trigger to make a million of them. So I think at an extreme level, they're forced to go do the analytical process, right? Mm-hmm. And same when a fab comes together, they're going to do $1 billion investment on a new dimension on a fab. There's a lot of work done prior to them turning that system on. And a lot of it is analytical work, very theoretical work. So I think there are circumstances where prototypes are amazingly expensive to get, and or they're very difficult to control so that you can actually run some margin testing or do other useful things with them, where the analytical side just makes perfect sense, right? The other part of a good analytical system to me is where you have fairly understandable or known failure mechanisms. Like in your case, you already knew that if you put just tin plate on a marine connector, it's probably, and just bare, or wire crimps, bare with copper exposed, it's probably not going to last all that long. Whereas in situations like that, where you already know what the failure mechanisms are, that analytical work then helps you to move past that. How do I avoid the corrosion? There's a number of analytical techniques to deal with that. Known stuff. And so I think those are cases where the analysis side wins. then
so what are the questions? So here's the thing. So our listeners, you know, what the question we always get is, what do I do? And I always come back with a set of questions to them to help them decide what to do. So what are the questions we ask back to make them bring to their dashboard the information that's important?
I'd summarize that, Adam, with just, well, what do you know and don't know? I mean, if you already know, if you're constrained that you're not going to get stuff to go to the lab with anyway, then there's no point in going into the testing realm, because unless you are very creative and want to invest in inventing testing algorithms.
Okay, but there's only two I think that the answer, there's two factors. So any answer they give has two factors to rank it by, and then simply in the end, it kind of will fall. I think the answer falls out of it, that it's money and time. So the question is, you know, with the two avenues, how much money and how much time? And, you know, of course, in association to, like, you know, if they obviously both have a likelihood of getting you where you want to be. I mean, if something has never been characterized before and doesn't have a model, the analytical side is, you know, not going to happen. But
I'm thinking of your money and time. It takes money and time to get the analytical models built. Right.
Because exactly. There can be more time and more money in some cases. So it's not that testing's only expensive or testing's longer. Testing can be shorter. We'll take the what you're talking about with Greg Hobbs and Wayne Nelson, right? So Greg Hobbs, very clearly on his side, has the time and money beat, right? Because he's like,
two prototypes in 3 days.
Days, $3,000, I got some answers for you.
That's right.
And you know, Wayne Nelson is like, all right, well, you have big analytical models, can take a long time.
It's 6 months and 25 samples.
Exactly. You do much longer, you know, testing to generate the data for the model, and then you use the model to project and da da da. So there's a lot of the questions come back to, okay, what information do you need? What are your time constraints and what are your budget constraints? And usually I find that the answer falls out pretty quickly, because usually one of them is a very intense constraint. So one team I worked with, their product cost like $1.2 million per unit, right?
So, and that's so, and the, th- that's and for sale. The prototype's probably more than that,
right? And their specific question to me is, we have to know, or this is a big company, and they were like, we will probably get driven out of business if this new version of this thing we have fails too early.
Right.
So they need to know the wear out model, which then Wayne Nelson's like, sure, give me 25. Give me a year, you know, and they're like, no.
Be fair. They're not going to do 25 full-up systems. You're going to probably work with them and say, well, is it this motor? Is it a pump? Is it a circuit board? Is it a power supply? Is it? And then you can get 25 of those, right?
With my punchline, how I helped them. But but it's actually the most extreme version of it you can imagine, because the problem was that the part that they just had evolved and invented was so much the heart of it that you pretty much almost needed the entire rest of the system to run it.
Right,
this is a laser system, a very advanced new technology laser system.
Okay.
And so you really, by the time you built a test stand around the part you cared about, you basically built the rest of the thing again.
Right.
So it's true. But then to try to do it in a way, we talked about doing it in ways where just the part was in a chamber or something and not stressing the rest of it. And that got hard. And so the answer ended up becoming, as I said, why don't we invent a different system, a simpler one that just can demonstrate just the technology part. So in other words, don't do the whole big core thing that you want to age. Let's go right down fully deep analytical to the physics of it and devise something that can demonstrate the comparative technologies. And we ended up designing that for about $25,000. So now we were talking, we could get some statistical significant. So actually, we ended up having to go an entire, you know, departure from testing the design to testing, you know, a feature of the design that then we could do statistics with and project out.
Right. So it there is a way, but when you're faced at, and I think that's a part that what you brought to them was that insight is, well, what is it we actually need to know? We don't need to know the whole system works. We have a question about this technology. Well, what about that technology? Let's narrow it down. Now, sometimes that's possible, right? But sometimes it's not. And so the analytical side is got these boundaries and barriers of what's feasible and possible. And you found a solution that said, all right, we can do this for, you know, relatively inexpensively, and we can get to the answers we're looking for and create those models and the understanding. But if you would have taken that same setup test rig and just overstressed it to fail, would that have provided sufficient information for them to make their decisions?
They're just to take a single one?
Yeah, take a single one and go break it and say, all right, where there's the limit, make it more robust.
Well, here's the thing. The answer would only come about depending on when it failed, and here's why. The reason why you're doing it is to create a distribution to characterize. Let's say it's as simple as a bell curve, right? And you want to know when whatever acceptable percentage of the left-hand tail of that bell curve crosses over to your end-of-life requirement, right? So you need to create that bell curve. You can't create a bell curve with a single point, right?
So you're dividing it where we need to know, is it going to live long enough? Right? Is enough percentage going to last long enough? Whereas Halt just fundamentally can't do it.
Right. So, I mean, obviously they aren't, you know, obviously this is a very small market, right? It's a very small volume of manufacturing, like, you know, handfuls is all they're ever going to sell.
You don't have one at your house? You don't have space ready for that unit to show up? I've been holding my garage for it to launch.
Yeah, exactly.
It's only $1 million. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We say stuff in the garage. I brought, anyway, forget it. I was going to say at dinner, we had some friends, my daughter's friends over, and one of them, this kid's very into engineering stuff. So we had a fly flying around, took a fly swatter, you know, one of those ones with electric and shocks it. And I was like, oh, wait, I have more powerful versions of this. I have an 80,000 kilovolt, like, cycler capacitor, another one too. And I brought them up to the table, and like, we're at the dinner table setting napkins on fire with it.
Oh, geez.
So I do have cockamamie stuff like that in the basement.
Yeah, okay. Fire extinguisher nearby.
Exactly. So, I mean, all the teenagers love me. So,
but I think, you know, and every now and then, I think it was Carl and I, a recent podcast, we were talking about reliability myths. And one of them was that if you are exploring margin, like doing Halt, looking for what amount of stress causes this to fail, is that it doesn't translate directly in any coherent way to it'll last 4 years and 8 months, right? It gives you margin, right? And you're trading off time to find where's the stress points, where's the weaknesses in your products, which is a completely different approach or philosophy than doing a 25 samples and measuring time to failure under a controlled experiment so that you know when the time to failure is.
But there's a reason why I said it depended on the answer. So you know, as I said, if you have a lot of data points, you can draw your bell curve and then, you know, obviously once you characterize it, project out the tails and see if it's acceptable. But when you have one, you can make a statement, you can say something, and it only works if you have your design has huge margins on the wear out life that you need.
Right.
Because what you can do is say that unit that failed was one of the best that could have been made, right?
Yeah, you assume it's
And then take a historical bell curve for similar technology and put that way out on the right end of the tail and see if the left end of the tail, you know, crosses over where you need. You're making a lot of assumptions, but you can do that if you think your technology has a huge margin to where this one point can take a historical bell curve and say, okay, we haven't messed it up too much.
Yeah. It always comes back to, well, what do you know and don't know in my mind? And that translates into time and money. And I think that if you just don't know what's going to fail, do Halt. Right. You have a brand new technology, go beat it up with appropriate stresses and find out where it fails. Right. Use case 7, give it to Adam and your teenage friends and go.
Blind robustness improvement is what I call it.
Yeah. It's a great term for it. And it's a much better acronym than HALT, which so many people think they can pass. I digress. But the idea is that if you don't know how it fails, that's your mission one. You got to go figure out where does it break and so that you know where to go make improvements. And you might need to switch over and characterize that to really understand if you made enough improvements or not. And then it goes back to, I think, your criteria, well stated, Adam, of time and money. But I just remember knowing both these two gentlemen and these polar opposites of approaches to reliability. Greg was always do Halt, do it early and often and keep on doing it. Why would you need to do anything else? And Wayne's sitting there just shaking his head going, you know, once you know how it fails, you need to understand why it fails and characterize that. And they, they agreed not to agree essentially on that approach, but they both looked at me as the arbiter going, well, in some cases I need to know this, in other cases I need to know that. And it depends on what question or what decision I'm trying to make, what question I'm trying to answer, and to let's pick the right tool for what we're trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, I question if they ever really didn't believe the other tool was valuable. There's probably some marketing in there. I mean, Dr. Hobbs made a lot of money on Halt.
Yeah.
And Wayne made a lot of money selling accelerated life testing books. So, but I mean, I can't imagine they both wouldn't argue that in the value of both. And any truly successful program pairs them. So we started off talking about the Apollo, program, and it's kind of fun program to study because it's such an extreme, right? Like mm-hmm. you said, you can't test a lot. You're pushing a lot of technology. And if you look at a lot of their kind of, if you look at their managerial approach to this technological development, it was very analytical for the reasons you stated. It's difficult to get samples and you can't go mess around in space and see what happens, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it was very analytical in nature. But you know, when Halt testing type philosophy came out is when the analytical methods really failed you.
Yeah.
And you tried to, and then at that point you had to do some testing to generate information. And one of the examples I love talking about, I call it the first Halt test before Halt ever existed. And it had to do with the Apollo, the thrust cone.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard me talk about this before? I don't know if I've ever shared this
with you. It sounds familiar, but yeah, no, I just imagine these out in the desert with great big rocket cones and blasting right away at them.
Yeah. So it was actually really risking stopping the entire program. They couldn't get a rocket cone. They couldn't get a thrust cone that didn't crack. And you obviously can't have that thing crack as you're taking off. And it had to be very light, handle insane forces, and its conditions changed dramatically as it went through the atmosphere and the external pressures changed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. And if you even see the modern day like space shuttle or other type cones, you can see how, you've seen those videos of them starting up and how they change shape and everything.
Yeah.
They kind of go through all these wobbly shapes and then all of a sudden like a tuning fork come into shape
yeah.
as the thrust comes into shape. And so that's the kind of stuff they were dealing with, and it just was shattering them. So they analytically couldn't come up with something that would work. And one engineer, younger engineer, was like, why don't we just blow them up? Why don't we just put black powder in there in the middle? And when you fire it off, it explodes and shatters them. And we can look at the way that the fracture marks and shredders are. And we know that was how they ultimately made a cone that could self-dampen under any frequency load or force load.
Oh, wow.
It would actually dampen. Yeah, exactly. And it was Halt testing, right?
Yeah,
before
yeah.
it was cold Halt testing. But somebody was like, the whole thing is we're chasing our tails. We can't analytically characterize the way this thing fractures. It just every time kind of surprises us. So why don't we just blow up a bunch of them and look at where they break? And now we know how the stresses move along. And mm-hmm. so it's really interesting. So it was analytical. And when analytical came to a dead end, the atom equivalent of 1965 was like, let's just blow it up. Like, and he probably, let's blow them up.
We need a lot of force very yeah. suddenly. And
stress and frustration, at yeah. least it'd be satisfying, So anyway, that's the kind of thing that happens in good programs where both tools are on the table and you understand both tools really well, both methods, both strategies. You've read Wayne Nelson's book and you've done a bunch of Halt tests.
Yep.
And as the problems approach you, even the same problem is going through evolutions of solving it, you correctly grab the right tool. And those are the successful programs, which is why when people ask me that, I always just – I hit them with a whole – bunch of questions, because that's what they need. They need to think about it and tease out all those details that help you make those decisions and come up with a strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well summarized. I was just about to channel Kirk a little bit here, but I'll save that for another conversation.
Oh, no.
To get going. I totally agree. And so I think we both vehemently agree that it's you have to have a range of tools available, and it goes to that realm. Now, I know that there's a folks out there that are fans of Kirk Gray and Halt in that whole realm, and there's also groups out there that are the Michael Peck physics of failure types that will see that end of it. And it's so let us know.
And they're all wrong. And every single one of them is wrong because they're all being myopic. That's
right.
Why.
So let's not offend them first. I was trying to get them give us some feedback there. But
you want feedback, insult people.
All right, there you go.
If you want the right answer to a question, don't ask the question, put out the wrong answer, and the people will correct you.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I've done that before. Not always on purpose.
Yeah. I'm okay, but you got a lot of problems to solve. That person's going to tell you something if you say that to him.
All right. So you hear that. So Adam says that you've got a lot of problems out there. You got a lot of work to do. But let us know what you think. Head over to ascendoverliability.com/go/SOR. And there's feedback forms there or comment forms, stuff like that. You can also find Adam and I on LinkedIn and on our about pages on ascendoverliability.com. But we'd love to hear from you because many of the topics and questions on our show. And you know, Adam, we're approaching our 500th show. It will be a couple of months. But as we're recording this, I think this is 465 or something like that.
500 shows. That's amazing.
I know. We're almost up there with Seinfeld, I think.
Except our show isn't about nothing.
That's right. No,
it's about something.
It takes a lot more work to do our show. So that's what we'll say it that way. All right. So even if you just appreciate the show and things you like and don't like, we appreciate that feedback also, obviously. So please let us know. Go out and break things if that's your challenge for the day, or go out and analyze things if that's going to be useful for you, or a little bit of both, whatever works for your program. So Adam, we'll talk to you again. Thanks so much for the topic.
All right. Take care, everybody. Bye, Fred.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.